I'm going to talk about the issue of gene patents, but a different wrinkle on it. I'm sure everyone in this room is at least somewhat familiar with the brewing controversy over whether our genes, what is us, should be subject to ownership rights by someone else, or by anyone for that matter. What's fallen under the radar screen and what I think will be the defining issue going forward is going to be not the patent to the gene itself, but to the information that results from the gene and from the genomic world of medicine that we're beginning to enter. And just to be on the level, I have nothing to disclose, nor do any of my co-authors. Actually, we have a lot to disclose, but not financial conflicts. This began really in 1980 in terms of the law's view of genes and life forms with the Supreme Court case in Diamond versus Chakravarty, in which the court said that bioengineered life forms, bioengineered bacteria, can be patented. And that was a seminal decision. It basically said that when humans play around with the genetic code, that is something new, it's something novel, it's not simply a form of nature, and so it is subject to patent ownership rights. So that little blob there in the lower left-hand corner is patentable, and the rights to use it can be owned by an individual or a corporation. The issue of patenting human genes stems from the Human Genome Project, begun in 1988. Congress empowered NIH and the Department of Energy to jointly begin a project to map the entire human genome. By 2002, the entire map had been developed. The first patents were issued in the early 90s, ironically at the instigation of NIH, which thought that they would establish a rule that the gene sequences that they were finding were patentable, and then they would get the patents and put them in the public domain. It didn't really turn out that way. Turned out that private entities were claiming these patents, but it began from there, and they created their own monster in a way. The question still remains, though, as to whether a human gene, a sequence of bases buried in each of our cells, is a human invention, a human discovery, or simply a product of nature. So what happened after NIH had his brilliant idea to establish the patentability of genes? By 2005, there were over 4,300 of them, 23,000 genes in the U.S. database. According to one estimate, almost 20% of all our genes are subject to some form of patent, in some cases conflicting patents, more than one. On the high side, it could even be double that number. They are held by over 1,000 organizations, private companies, universities, and others. And you can see here, actually, the biggest single patent holder is University of California, but it's followed by several biotech and big pharma companies. So it's not simply an issue of private corporations versus everyone else, but it is an issue of private organizations versus our genes. And it has obviously been quite controversial. This is an ad from the ACLU, which has been launching a campaign for some time now to overrule gene patents. Just very briefly, the world of patent law works in a sort of bizarre way compared to other aspects of administrative law. You file for a patent, and it's decided purely at the bureaucratic level. An official of the Patent and Trademark Office decides whether to issue one. They're in the business of patents. They tend to like patents, and they tend to err on the side of granting patents. But once challenged, about 50% of all patents are thrown out in court. So you can get your patent, but it's really not a safe bet until it's gone to court and been approved. So that is the status of all of these gene patents. The Patent and Trademark Office takes the position that they're valid. We have courts ruling different ways, and as I'll explain in a minute, we are waiting for the Supreme Court to give definitive guidance. You get something like this, which is not really readable as a slide, but it gives you a sense of how much information there is and how many of those snippets are subject to patent. Okay, so a lot of these genes, we don't really know what they do. As soon as segments have been isolated often. Whatever lab has found them has rushed out and filed for a patent, often defensively, to prevent someone else from getting it. As we are finding more and more, as George Annis showed us, there are genes that are linked with predisposition to specific diseases. And perhaps the most studied of those are the two BRCA genes, numbers 1 and 2. And this is a picture of them. I don't know if you can see the little red area in the middle of those two genes. That's a BRCA gene. BRCA stands for breast cancer gene because it was first associated with breast cancer. It is highly associated with susceptibility to either breast or ovarian cancer. It sits here on chromosome 17, pretty much in the middle, at least BRCA1. In its normal form, what that gene does is DNA repair. So it's essentially a tumor suppressor. When there's a problem with the DNA, it can fix it. The mutations make that defective, and therefore the tumors, as they arise, are not repaired and not prevented. To sort of review the history, as I said, the genes were discovered in 1990. They were isolated in 1994 and 95. The mutations were shown, and I'll show you some figures in a minute, to be highly correlated with increased risk. Homozygotes, where you have two copies of the defective gene, are much more lethal than heterozygotes, where you have only one copy, because if you have one copy, then the other gene can be doing the tumor repair. When you have two copies of the defective gene, you have nothing there doing the tumor repair. In the overall population, it's about a tenth of a percent where you find this pattern, but in some ethnic groups, it is much higher, and this is important diagnostically as well as from a research point of view. Ashkenazic Jews, it's about 1 in 40. Among those who go on to develop ovarian cancer, it's about 40%, and among those who develop breast cancer, it's about 10%. And then other populations have been found to high prevalence as well, disparate areas from North Africa to Iceland and French Canada. The key to assessing the risk, though, is not just that you have the gene, but to look at it in the context of family history and ethnicity, which has a tremendous amount to do with the predictive value of the test. So I don't know if you can read those figures, but if you look at the lower left-hand one, you can see the difference in incidence of cancer among those who have the BRCA mutations and those who do not. We're up to about 60% for one mutation over the course of a lifetime up to age 80 of getting cancer, as opposed to a risk of about 10%. And the one on the lower right, you can see in the 50 to 60 age group, that's when that difference is most pronounced in terms of incidence. This is a summary of some of the findings. Those statistics vary, but everyone has found a significantly increased incidence. And you can see here again, BRCA1 is up to 70% by age 90, BRCA2 up to about 50%. Together, they come to close to 100%. So a lot of women have had the test, basically 100,000 by now, risk assessed through family history. Now we come to the story of Myriad Genetics, founded in 1991 to look for opportunities to isolate genes and patent them. They hit the jackpot when they patented BRCA1 and 2 in the late 90s. There were multiple patents on the genes. They were very aggressive in enforcing their rights. They have sued, they've threatened litigation, they have bought up patent rights so that they now are the exclusive providers of the test. It is basically their entire business model, 88% of their business. The test now costs $3,000 to $4,000. It's usually covered by insurance, but not always. And they've been vigorous in enforcing it, in some cases against basic researchers, against clinicians, not just against other testing companies. So they are facing some challenges now. The litigation that I described brought by the ACLU and some research organizations, this woman, who is one of the named plaintiffs, one of the patients, and several others, trying to overturn the patent and all gene patents. They were successful in a district court in Brooklyn in 2010. That was overruled by the appeals court, the Federal Circuit that hears patent appeals. An interesting decision. They said that the patent on the genes was valid because the court claimed, may not be scientifically valid, that there is a different composition to it once it's isolated than when you find it actually in someone's genes, but they said that most of the patents on the tests were not valid because they're just mental activity. It was appealed to the Supreme Court, which sent it back again to review it in light of its decision of involving a diagnostic test by a company called Prometheus. Supreme Court will probably hear the case again within the next couple of years, and by then we should have some definitive guidance. But in the meantime, Myriad has this patent. They are facing some threats. There are different technologies now that use public databases to compare risk to genetic profile. Home testing may be able to solve this problem. Patents will begin to expire in the next few years because they run for 20 years from date of test of filing. And they're having some trouble in Europe, where they're much more skeptical of gene patents. They actually got a patent which was then rescinded. They claim that their technology is better than the potential competitors. Who knows, but they may not be able to get their monopoly in Europe. So what are they going to do? They have this database, which is a goldmine. Every woman who's been tested, they have the findings, they have outcomes for most of them, and they have family histories for most of them. And that is important because of what are known as variants of unknown significance. When you get a test result, sometimes it shows a mutation that we know what it means. Often it shows a mutation that is new, that we don't know what it means. Myriad has found about 18,000 of those to date, about 5 to 10% of all results, higher in the African-American and Hispanic communities. When you find one of those, you need to do an analysis based on some of the factors I described, family history, patterns in families, population frequency, and so forth. And how do you do that? You use the database. In 2006, there was a paper finding that Myriad was producing a lot of these variants of unknown significance. They put in a supplemental test. They started mining their database. They got those figures down. They claimed to 3%, slightly higher for some minority populations, all of that because of their database. They have begun to withhold data from the database. Up until 2004, they were depositing it into a public database maintained by NIH, the Breast Cancer Information Corps. They have also been more non-disclosive with requests from clinicians and researchers to analyze the database when these variants of unknown significance come back. This appears to be a strategic decision because what it means is they can maintain their monopoly. When the patents expire, or if the patents are thrown out by the Supreme Court, or if they never get a patent in Europe, they still have the database, and no one else does. And a startup company would be at a disadvantage from stage one. Where do you want your results to go, your test to go? To a company that can compare it to 100,000 other test results, or to a company that's starting from scratch? Potentially, this is a way of maintaining the monopoly, maybe indefinitely. Significant larger issue is how important the data has become, more important even than the patents in terms of the economics of genomics. So what do we do about that? On the one hand, we like the monopoly because it means all the data is aggregated in one place. If there were a lot of different companies, you'd have data in different places. You wouldn't have 100 or several hundred thousand people in a database, but we want it accessible for clinicians and researchers and other legitimate uses. In terms of reform, what are our goals? We should be promoting aggregation of data. This is crucial to the advance of genomics, but we should be guaranteeing access, and we should be doing something to mitigate the competitive pressures to do what Myriad seems to be doing to withhold access. So we're not talking about getting rid of patents. We're talking about tailoring them to genomics where something is different and where information interacts with them in a way it really doesn't in other spheres. A couple of ideas we have is to take some existing laws to tinker with HIPAA or with the rules that approve the patent by the FDA under CLIA, the Lab Act, to require that as a condition of approval for the tests, that they aggregate data and permit access to it. Another possibility we're looking at is to have NIH provide a public database and require that either as a condition of the patent or approval of the test that your results be deposited. And then there would have to be some funding mechanism to reward the company for doing this, either an excise tax on the tests or perhaps giving them an exclusive period followed by mandating access to the data. So I will conclude with the source of all of our law, the United States Constitution. Patents are meant to encourage innovation. Whether they are for genes or not is not clear. But if we decide that we're going to go that way, that's fine. But they are meant to be for limited times. Our founding fathers recognized as much. And they should be promoting the advance of science and continual research, not just research that produces a gene, but research that continues to promote research with it. And I can give this out later. This is our paper with our preliminary conclusions, and we hope there will be more. Thank you.